Crimea is a fortified Russian-occupied state. Since its illegal annexation by the Russian regime in 2014, it has been subject to a brutal process of colonization and settlement. Now, in the face of Putin's historic error to launch a full-scale invasion of Ukraine, the question of decolonization of the peninsula has been sharply posed. Today we discuss what this decolonization might look like and what it means for the fall of empires in the 21st century.
The Russian invasion of Ukraine. Russian troops spreading out throughout the strategic Crimean Peninsula.
With cheering crowds greeting him, Russian President Vladimir Putin made his first visit since Russia annexed Crimea from Ukraine.
Welcome to the Another Europe podcast with me, Luke Cooper. Our guest on today's show is Masha Sinkarenko, a research associate at the Institute of Human Sciences and an expert on the Russian annexation and colonization of Crimea and the Crimean Tatar National Movement. With Ukraine's counteroffensive setting itself the strategic goal of taking back the peninsula from Russia, we talked to her about what decolonization of Crimea will look like and the implications for how we understand democracy and anti-imperialism today. This podcast is part of the Ukraine and the World project, which is organised in collaboration with Foreign Policy in Focus, a platform based at the Institute for Policy Studies, a progressive think tank in the United States, and our long-standing partner, European Alternatives, who are rethinking the nation-state in Europe and beyond. We'll be publishing a series of articles, blogs, and podcasts across our platforms exploring the war against Ukraine as a major inflection point in global history, requiring new thinking and analyses from progressives on how to address the problems of our crisis-ridden world. Members of Another Europe is Possible get access to additional podcast material as a benefit of joining our campaign. To join and support our work, go to anothereurope.org/join. Hi, Masha. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello, Luke. Thank you so much for having me.
It's really great to be having this conversation. And it was really great to see you at the academic workshop we were both at a couple of weeks ago. And thanks for agreeing to follow up those discussions with a chat here. Look, a lot of people are going to listening to the podcast are going to be very new to Crimea's place and position within the Ukrainian national question and within the history, a broader history and contested history, of course, of Russia and Ukraine. So could we start by really going back to basics? What is it about Crimea's history that makes it a bit different from other parts of Ukraine?
Sure, that's a great question, Luke. Well, what's interesting about Crimea is that despite the fact that it has been part of Ukraine only since 1954, its history is actually very similar to the history of the rest of Ukraine. So today we refer to that history as a colonial history, when the foreign empire conquered the territory and subjugated its indigenous population. So in the case of the rest of Ukraine, it's Ukrainians and indigenous Crimean Tatars in Crimea, respectively. And in both contexts, Ukrainian and Crimea, we have Russian Empire conquering the territories in the 18th century and trying to make them Russian. In the 20th century, both Crimea and mainland Ukraine developed strong nationalist movements that produced political elites, both Ukrainian and Crimean Tatars in Crimea, which capitalized on the collapse of the Russian Empire and sought to establish their own states. And in both cases, these attempts failed when the Bolsheviks cracked down on those nationalist, newly established governments and proclaimed that Ukrainian and Crimean territories were now part of the USSR. So as you see, this history is very similar, but of course, there are also the biggest difference between those historical experiences, in my opinion, is the form that colonialism took there. So in the case of mainland Ukraine, it was what we see today, the erasure of Ukrainian identity, language, culture through institutional violence and assimilation policies. So Ukrainians were accepted only insofar as they embraced and internalized the Russian imperial culture and language. In the case of Crimea, the indigenous Turkish Crimean Tatars were racialized differently than Ukrainians. They couldn't become Russian even if they wanted to. So instead, Crimea was Russified through settler colonial practices and demographic engineering. So through land deprivation, vilification, Crimean Tatars were first encouraged to leave Crimea, as we see in after the Crimean War, or after 1944, when they were deported to Central Asia. So as a result, if we look at the demographic statistics, if on the verge of Crimea's first annexation in 1783, Crimean Tatars constituted 90% of the population, after 1944, there were zero. So over the centuries, Russian Empire and then Soviet Empire resettled ethnic Russians to Crimea to Russify the peninsula, making it today predominantly Russian. And that's the main differences in the history of Crimea and the rest of Ukraine.
Thank you. That's a brilliantly eloquent and clear introduction to the history. So can we come a little bit further to the present day, by which I mean in this long sweep of history, the last 30 years, and Ukrainian independence? One thing that is often argued mistakenly is this idea that Russian speakers in Ukraine are ethnic Russians. Now, in Crimea, as for the historical reasons that you have suggested, there's a difference, isn't there? Because settlers in Crimea are Russian often, or there are Russians in Crimea, in a way that it's mistaken to talk about that in eastern Ukraine. Could you explain some of that difference for us? And how does this affect Crimea's vote for independence alongside Ukraine in 1991?
Sure. So yeah, as I mentioned before, as you summarized, that when people mistakenly say that Crimea is pro-Russian or the majority is ethnic Russians, well, this is because of the context that I just described. This is not the indigenous people that have been living in Crimea for a very long time. These are the settlers that have been specifically deliberately resettled to change the demographics and therefore to legitimize the Russian rule. Nevertheless, in the referendum for Ukraine's independence in 1991, Crimea voted for Ukraine's independence. So if we recall, the referendum took place on December 11, 1991, and the turnout was 83% all over Ukraine. 90% supported independence with fluctuations across the regions. In Crimea particularly, 54% voted in favor of independence. There were not a single district that voted against the independence. 54% may seem as the low number compared to the rest of Ukraine, but it is still pretty good considering the context that I just provided. And I think the main reason why Crimea voted in favor of Ukraine's independence is sort of self-preservation. Because if we recall the situation in Crimea in the 1990 and 1991, it was incredibly chaotic and the Soviet Union was disintegrating and the states were declaring independence one after another. Crimea in 1991 has been already part of Ukraine's Soviet Socialist Republic for almost 40 years. And it was very well connected to the mainland in terms of the infrastructure, water supply, electricity, and so on. So voting against independence would have meant more destabilization for people. In addition, the Crimean Tatars have been at that time massively returning to their homeland from the places of exile. And they also overwhelmingly voted for Ukraine's independence, adding more votes. Some even say that it's because of the Crimean Tatars that the support for independence were over 50%. Why they were voting pro-Ukrainian, it's another question. I guess Crimean Tatars have developed very strong connections with the Ukrainian dissidents in the Soviet Union. They had a very similar experience of oppression and deportation to gulags and all those places. And so they were already established ties, and they were already very favorable of each other. And also the most important pro-Ukrainian party, Ruch, that was active in Crimea in the early 90s, also supported the return of the Crimean Tatars and even supported the idea of Crimean Tatar self-determination. So even before, Crimean Tatars have developed what we see today as this Ukrainian civic identity. They have already been voting in the very first referendum for Ukraine's independence.
Yeah, I like that analysis of Crimea, those in Crimea wanting to kind of get out of this enterprise that was going bankrupt, that was the Soviet Union, essentially, this desire to escape to a different and democratic future, because of course it brings into question precisely this democracy issue. So Ukraine and Russia nearly came to conflict over Crimea in the 1990s, and it has remained a very prized, if you like, asset for Russia and the idea of the Russian Empire that Putin and others inside Russia have done so much to generate again afresh in the 21st century. So when Russia annexed it in 2014, it had quite a lot of support inside Russia. Could you tell us about the annexation and some of that history?
Sure. So going back to the 90s, as you rightly pointed out, Russia has seen Crimea as its crown jewel. It has been historically seen as such for the Russian Empire, Soviet Union, Russian Federation. Culturally, over the centuries, it really became the symbol of Russian civilizing mission. It was seen as Russian Riviera, where the nobles would come vacate in the summer. The Black Sea landscape was glorified in the works of Pushkin, Tolstoy, Chekhov, and other Russian classics. So we understand why Crimea has been so important to the Russian myth-making. It is worth noting that this colonial situation didn't really end with the proclamation of Ukraine's independence. Russia has since still seen Crimea as its own kind of this colonial outpost, although at that time it didn't really have the military capabilities to fight for it. So we see not really a military intervention, but this kind of hybrid neocolonialism in Crimea in the form of sponsoring of pro-Russian parties, paramilitary groups, investing and buying lots of property, businesses, investing in Russian culture, sponsoring the departments of Russian culture and language at the universities. So basically really continuing this imposition of Russian culture and Russian politics and Russian money. And at the same time, of course, resisting everything Ukrainian, everything Crimean Tatar. At the same time, there was no really a separatist movement in Crimea in its kind of classical form. In the early 90s, there has been a Crimean leader, Yuri Mishkov, who had a separatist platform, but it died out pretty fast, actually, because Yeltsin, who were then the president of the Russian Federation, was actually not really interested in supporting that separatism. So that movement kind of died out in the early 90s. And ever since then, there were no strong separate tendencies. It was very pro-Russian. There were a lot of Russian money, Russian assets, Russian initiatives, but no political movement for kind of reunification with Russia. What happened in 2014 is that Russia basically used the momentum of Ukraine's post-revolutionary weakness when Ukraine had just overthrown its pro-Russian kleptocratic corrupt president and kind of remained in a state of temporary political vacuum. And Russian leadership, of course, saw Ukraine and Crimea still as its colonial appendage. And it was realizing that this is the time when they were losing Ukraine and they couldn't control it anymore through their proxies, who they saw the president Yanukovych as such. So they decided to use military violence to preserve their control. And it was easier to do it in Crimea because they had been for years preparing the ground there. And it was just a perfect time to strike when Ukraine was at its weakest. And unfortunately, as we see, there was very weak response from the global community. And this is why Crimea is occupied by Russia for 9 years now. And this is why Russia was emboldened to begin its full-scale invasion.
So moving to your own engagement with Crimea, it's the subject matter of your PhD that you've completed. Why did you decide to take it as the subject of your PhD? And you conducted fieldwork there in 2020, I believe. What was that like? Could you tell us a bit about it?
Sure. I decided to study Crimean Tatars and Crimea both for personal and intellectual reasons. I have been regularly visiting Crimea as a child all throughout my childhood, and it has been a very dear place for me. But also I was just struck by my own ignorance, because when the annexation happened in 2014 and I learned about the oppression of the Crimean Tatars and learned about the Crimean Tatar culture and history, I was struck because this was the first time that I actually learned that. We didn't study it in school. I never encountered that history in Crimea when I was there on vacation. So there was this real gap in knowledge, even though I was so close to that context. So that was kind of the personal reason why I decided to go deep into the subject. And then more intellectual reason is that I was interested academically in nonviolent resistance at that time. And it seemed to me that there has been not much said about the Crimean Tatar national movement for return to Crimea that lasted almost more than 40 years. It was completely nonviolent, and I decided to study that. As a result of my fieldwork and my research, I switched a little bit the direction of my topic, but I still stayed with Crimea and Crimean Tatars. Now, regarding the Crimea and my experience of doing fieldwork there, so Crimea, as I said, is under Russian occupation since 2014. And that means that every aspect of people's lives is regulated by Russian legislation, and people were forced to take Russian passports if they wanted to return in their homes, to keep their employment, to have access to healthcare, and so on. The economic situation is very dire because Crimea is under sanctions from the EU and the US, and Ukraine doesn't supply water and electricity anymore, so it's completely isolated. There is no trade with Crimea except for in kind of this internal trade with Russia. There are no flights, no tourism, no businesses. So it's a very depressing place to be, and I can't even imagine how depressing it must be to live there. It is also incredibly militarized. Since the annexation, Crimea has been turned into a huge military base, and it remains this launching pad for their missile strikes on Ukraine. You can see this cult of World War II everywhere on display, enormous billboards in school curriculum, everywhere. So this obsession with the war. So that was still present even before the full-scale invasion. Also, Crimea is deeply authoritarian. Russian occupying authorities basically rule there by force. The Crimean Tatars and Ukrainians are the most vulnerable groups. Crimean Tatars particularly are charged with falsified charges of extremism and terrorism. And there are currently more than 150 Crimean Tatars serving their 20-year sentences. So their Islamophobia is just overwhelming. And Ukrainians are also targeted for their support of Ukraine. For example, you can go to prison for having a Ukrainian flag or speaking Ukrainian. So when I was doing my field work, of course, there was this really strong sense of terror when you know that you're being surveilled, that any moment a black car can wait for you at the hotel and so on. So my respondents, which were all of them were Crimean Tatars, they were afraid to talk to me in the parks or in restaurants or any other public space. So we usually held our conversations in their homes or in some other places which they were sure were not surveilled. Yeah, so I was very glad when I finally made it to the Ukrainian administrative line and saw the Ukrainian flag. Many Crimean Tatars describe that feeling when you go to Crimea, that there is no law that can protect you, and then they describe it as if there is no air to breathe. And that's the exact experience that I had.
Yeah, it's so interesting to hear that description. I suppose I would say two things that it has come to my mind. The first is that your description very, very much resonates with what my LSE colleague Mary Kaldor says about her trip to the border between Ukrainian administrated territory and Crimea, as it was then shortly after the Maidan revolution and the revolution of dignity, and therefore the annexation of Crimea that we've been talking about, in the sense that she always likes to point out that fundamentally this was a question of democracy that was crucially paramount. Crimea and the autonomous territory had a democratic reforming government that was overthrown, of course, by the occupying authorities, and actually had Crimean Tatar representation, of course, in that government too. And yeah, the second thing that strikes me from your description is the terror that was already present prior to the full-scale invasion. Do we have much information of what it's like now after the full-scale invasion? Presumably that situation has got much, much worse. I mean, with the accumulation of the international sanctions regime, with the fierce fighting between the government of Ukraine and Russia and so on, presumably those tendencies that you've already saw very visibly on your trip in 2020, we can anticipate that they're much worse now.
Yeah, exactly. So if before the full-scale invasion, Crimea has been this military base that we're just preparing to launch its attack. And by the way, when no one in mainland Ukraine believed that Russia is going into a full war, my respondents in Crimea, they were confident that this will happen one day, because otherwise, why would you accumulate so much military equipment? So now, because it is a full-scale war, Russians are using all that military capabilities to strike Ukraine. And of course, it impacts the lives of ordinary Crimeans, because also Ukraine is striking back. Another thing that changed is that the discrimination of Crimean Tatars is not only in Islamophobia that was there present, in random arrests, searches, interrogations, and so on. But there is now another dimension of oppression in that they are disproportionately drafted to the Russian army. And this is especially painful, not only because Crimean Tatars don't have a choice, but also because Crimean Tatars identify very strongly as Ukrainians. So when they are being sent to fight Ukrainians, they are basically fighting against their brothers.
We've talked quite a bit already about the Crimean Tatars, so I thought that perhaps this is just an opportunity to say, well, could we say, going back to basics again, like the Crimean Tatars, as you've just indicated, they're Muslim, predominantly Muslim, Turkic, of Turkic ethnic heritage. and of course, as you said at the beginning of the podcast, were expelled under Stalin's diktat in the Soviet Union. So a terrible act of ethnic cleansing of the peninsula. So today, as you've just said, they identify very strongly as Ukrainian, as part of the Ukrainian civic community, if you like. I'm just interested to draw that out a bit further. So is that a recent phenomenon, this sense of imagining themselves very strongly as Ukrainian? Is there a point in history we can go back to where that became very paramount? I'd be really interested to hear more about that topic.
I will just add a little bit more context to what you've already said. So Crimean Tatars, after the deportation in 1944, they have been resisting very strongly to get back to Crimea, from which they were not allowed to get back there until the collapse of the Soviet Union. So after they got back, they have constituted around 13% of Crimea's population. So they have been a minority still. After the annexation, tens of thousands of Crimean Tatars left Crimea again and resettled in Ukrainian cities, in Kyiv, in Lviv, in Vinnytsia. So they clearly see the annexation as just another imperial conquest of Russia, and they have been very actively opposing it. Of course, when they returned to Crimea in the early 90s, it was the very first time in the history when Crimea was part of independent Ukraine. So before that, Crimean Tatars never lived in Ukraine. So of course, it would be difficult to expect people to identify with a state to which they have no relationship. But as I mentioned, they were supportive of Ukraine because it was already a country that was moving in the direction of democracy, liberalism. It was moving towards the European Union. And these are all the values that Crimean Tatars in their vast majority share as well. So the critical juncture, I would say, was the Revolution of Dignity. And this is when a lot of Ukrainians too came to really kind of call themselves Ukrainians, because as we know, before that, the Ukrainian identity for many people, it wasn't absent, but it was not very relevant. After the Revolution of Dignity and with the Russian invasion, it had this backfiring effect where lots of people started identifying as Ukrainians, speaking Ukrainian language, really appreciating Ukrainian culture, and so on. And the Crimean Tatars, as people who lived in Ukraine for, at that time, already 24, 25 years, who have been Ukrainian citizens for several decades, they were also part of that process of developing the civic identity. And many Crimean Tatars already in 2014 formed their own battalions to fight Russian soldiers. And a lot of them were disappointed with the fact that Ukraine decided not to wage war when the annexation happened. There are all different reasons why it didn't happen, but Crimean Tatars indeed now feel that they were left alone or let down, and really wish that Ukrainian state will come back. I think there is a lot of hope right now, because when I was there in 2020, there were no hope, no expectation. There were no reason to suggest that in the near future, Crimea can be deoccupied. Now there is a reason, and now the Ukrainian government is talking about the inevitability of the deoccupation of Crimea. So I think that a lot of Crimean Tatars are really hoping for that to happen.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's so interesting to hear your description of what you called critical junctures that have over time produced this sense of Ukrainianness amongst the Crimean Tatar population, and particularly the role of the Revolution of Dignity as this major turning point I'm a real fan of Benedict Anderson's book on the origins of nationalism, and particularly the term he uses, imagined communities, that actually what you've just described in a way is a group of Crimean Tatars not just joining but actually reinventing, if you like, a imagined community. So when Ukraine emerges as something more inclusive, then in a way that also reinvents Ukraine at the same time. And I'll segue from there into my next question, which is about this idea of colonization and decolonization in Crimea. You know, for lots of people, and you've written a Commons article about this, basically trying to move the discussion on a bit about decolonization in Crimea. So in the Commons article, you're critical of this idea that decolonization of Crimea simply means a Russian withdrawal. And you're also critical of this idea of generating new Ukrainian myths about Crimea in place of Russian myths about Crimea. Could you tell us a little bit more about that analysis? What do you think decolonization looks like for this democratic Ukrainian civic polity? You know, would it involve, I don't know, federalization or something at the same time as decolonization?
I think many people confuse deoccupation with decolonization. In my mind, deoccupation is a political goal achieved by military, diplomatic, or a combination of both ways. It means basically restoring Ukraine's territorial integrity. Decolonization is a much longer political process that seeks restoration of justice, where justice is understood as a construction of political and social order that reverses or remedies these inequalities or hierarchies that formed over the centuries. For example, it's not enough just to liberate Crimea and restore Ukraine's statehood. We need to think how previously oppressed categories of people, for example, Crimean Tatars, who have been excluded for centuries from political economic opportunities, can now access those opportunities. So how can Crimean Tatars, who have been deprived of their ancestral land and access to housing, how can they be compensated for that loss? How can the Crimean Tatar language and culture be given a priority in cultural policies? So those issues are not going to be solved by themselves. They need deliberate policies. Unfortunately, as I criticize in the Commons article, I don't see that the Ukrainian government or civil society is thinking in those terms. Decolonization is largely seen through this Ukrainian lens of bringing Ukrainian speakers and turning Crimea into a Ukrainian-speaking place, or restoring Ukrainian laws and norms and legislation and so on. And I'm not opposing these ideas. I think that as part of Ukraine, Crimea should speak Ukrainian and it should adhere to Ukrainian legislature. But the process will not be fair if it doesn't take into account the indigenous people that have been oppressed. And if Ukraine doesn't do the steps to remedy this situation, well, it will only, first of all, reproduce these inequalities instead of solving them. And second, it will not be really that different from the Russian Empire that we are fighting right now.
Yeah, and how does the language politics map onto this question? It's something that's often discussed in Ukraine. I mean, I don't want to take us off topic here, but do most Crimean Tatars speak Ukrainian, for instance, as the language they use at home in everyday life? I was wondering how that affects things.
Crimean Tatars have been Russified to the extent that many of them don't even speak Crimean Tatar language. So many Crimean Tatars unfortunately speak Russian at home, in public sphere. Now, since the 2014, there has been those attempts to revive the Crimean Tatar language. It has been very difficult, of course, under the Russian oppressive machine that kind of prohibits everything Crimean Tatar. But a lot of Crimean Tatars who moved to mainland Ukraine over those years, they have actually learned Ukrainian and they speak Ukrainian, and they really are eager to speak Ukrainian, even if it's difficult for them. Of course, a lot of Crimean Tatars just living in Ukraine for a lot of years before the annexation have also learned Ukraine, not even because they lived in a Ukrainian-speaking society, but quite the opposite. They lived in a Russian-speaking society that Crimea was, but in spite of that, they put effort into learning the state language. So I think that they will be actually very favorable to speaking and learning Ukrainian. At the same time, I think that the Ukrainian state, I think that they understand and they should understand that this switch towards Ukrainian language will not be fast, and it shouldn't be fast. There should be a transition period which will allow the opportunities for people to learn Ukrainian, first of all, and then also really focus on the development of the Crimean Tatar language. And I think that the most desired or preferable outcome would be to have Crimean Tatar language as the second official language in Crimea. And that would mean that every Crimean Tatar who would want to get public services in Crimean Tatar language would be able to do that. But this is a very kind of optimistic thinking that I have, and it will require, of course, a lot of effort and a lot of political will, and we are not there yet, so this is just something to dream about.
Yeah, and that's super interesting. And I suppose listeners should be aware that, or may have heard, that you know there are some restrictions that were introduced in the last Ukrainian national language law on the use of Russian as an official language. But I just wanted to emphasize that law is very explicit, that it doesn't, whatever you think about it, it doesn't persecute the use of Russian as a private language in a way that it is sometimes presented in some spheres. So it's just important to acknowledge that. Doesn't mean that it's not contentious and it's been criticized by the Council of Europe and others, but I don't want to take us off topic. The thing that I wanted to ask you about, though, is how does this affect the self-determination question? So you've talked also about the Crimean Tatar self-determination as part of a vision for a decolonized Ukraine. But also, as you mentioned earlier in the conversation, the Crimean Tatar population at the time of the Russian annexation was 13% of Crimea, and is probably smaller now as a result of the Russian occupation. So it's clearly nowhere near a majority. So how does self-determination need to be defined to take into account this emphasis that you're rightly pursuing around historical justice for this excluded and persecuted indigenous population?
I think that there has been a tension between the notion of self-determination after that resulted in the aftermath of the post-World War II anti-colonial movements that kind of sees or equalizes self-determination as only possible with the full independence or sovereignty. I think that in the case of the Crimean Tatars, the self-determination in no way presumes independence or sovereignty. They perfectly understand that, first of all, they are the minority in Crimea. Second of all, Crimea is not self-sufficient without Ukraine. So the self-determination in their case can mean all many different things. I really would not like to impose my own vision of self-determination, because there is no consensus among the Crimean Tatars. They are working on different models that can be implemented. So I would rather say that there are several different models of self-determination that does not really presupposes any form of independence or parallel state or anything like that. When they talk about self-determination, that means the autonomous status of Crimea. As you know, Crimea has been, prior to the annexation, it had the status of the Autonomous Republic of Crimea within the Ukrainian state. And that autonomous status could provide them potentially with ways to kind of flatten those inequalities that have been previously produced. So, for example, one way would be to have a quota of parliament seats in the parliament of the Autonomous Republic. In fact, Crimean Tatars had that quota from 1994 to 1998. It was only for one election cycle, and after that it was abandoned. So having a quota of Crimean Tatar MPs would really provide Crimean Tatars with opportunities to participate in Crimea's political life. This is something that they, if there is no parliament in Crimea, then it would be very, very difficult for them to do something on a national level. Another way of the self-determination is this cultural autonomy, which means, as I mentioned, proclaiming Crimean Tatar language as the second language of Crimea, for example, the second official language. It can also be allocating more resources to the recovery or revival of Crimean Tatar national heritage or cultural initiatives, things like that. So these are the kind of forms of self-determination that people are talking about, and they do not include independence or any form of separatism.
That concludes the podcast for those listening on the podcast platforms. Members of Another Europe get access to extra podcast material as a benefit of membership. To join and support our work, go to anothereurope.org/join. In this extra time, we talk about the broader implications for Crimea's liberation, for how we understand resistance to imperialism.